and are not used. Such discoveries gradually accumulate to form intellectualism. Intellectualism being nothing but a mass of discoveries which have become so fascinating in themselves that we have no inclination to do anything with them. Facts that are held for their own sake alone. Discoveries by which we are amazed and astonished, and sometimes impelled to sit down with a certain attitude of awe that we are able to be so stupendous as to make these discoveries. And of course, an attitude of greater awe to other people who have made bigger ones. And yet the question remains, what has been done with any of it? This inevitably leads to the danger of developing also experiences internally that have no relation or valid foundation in the discoveries which we have made. It is a mistake to take a discovery and do nothing with it. And it is a greater mistake sometimes to take a very small discovery and try to do more with it than the facts justify. The moment we depart from the fact, or depart from the natural boundaries of the discovery, we pass from valid experience into an invalid kind of experience, an experience which becomes experimental, becomes over-emotional, over-intense, and by trying to transcend the discovery which we may land in hallucination or fanaticism, both of which arise from conduct, intense, but not sustained by discovery. Discovery always implies that we have perceived the working of a law. And having satisfied ourselves that this law operates and is valid, we then take this law unto ourselves and into ourselves and incorporate it into our pattern of conduct regulations. If we do this continuously, gaining a little insight every day, and through this experiencing a little more from within ourselves every day, we shall move interiorly and exteriorly in harmony and in proper relationship. There will then be no conflict between the material person and his supermaterial interior life. Conflict arises from the material nature of man moving in one direction and his aspirational structure moving in a contrary direction. If these move together like 2 feet, carrying the one man along, each step measured by the counterstep, each move balanced by an appropriate move of both parts of the moving equipment, then we have the person progressing, growing, unfolding according to the natural way of life. Under such growth, what we commonly know as self-delusion is almost impossible. This does not mean that we can begin and immediately eliminate all errors, or that we can transform ourselves from the sinner to the saint in a night. It means, however, that for hope and for optimism, we are substituting a factual procedure derived from nature, supported by conscience, and justified by interior and exterior experience. Moving in this way, we move with propriety. And if we study mysticism, we shall discover something of the direction in which this motion usually leads us, a motion which has been recorded in the lives and characters of innumerable persons of varying degrees of interior enlightenment. We observe, of course, among all these persons, a gradual diminishing of certain aggressive attitudes. Attitudes which in themselves and of themselves are obviously not factual. They are not factual because we discover, if we become attentive, that these processes produce ill rather than good. And if by our works we shall know them, we cannot justify that which does not justify itself in action. Therefore, regardless of our feelings, any thought, emotion, or action which produces a destructive or negative result cannot be justified, cannot be factual, because nature is not factually decreeing annihilation. Nature is attempting continuously to rescue things from the tendency which they possess to destroy or injure themselves. If we attempt to rationalize and try to indicate that ends justify means, that in our way of life it is impossible for us to practice certain virtues revealed to us as factual by our own power of experience discovery, if we annihilate or assail the right of these facts to dominate our own conduct, we then place ourselves in a situation which is likely to prove completely detrimental. We observe, therefore, that if a pattern of living is not producing in the individual a reasonable similitude of that which he desires with rightness of desire, or that which he intuitively apprehends to be right, or if more obviously the things that he is doing are producing detrimental, negative, or destructive results upon himself or others, then his experience discovery mechanism demands that these things be changed. The discovery mechanism shows him that he is wrong. Further discovery mechanism may give him some insight as to what is right. He cannot depend upon right being in this case an action opposite to wrong. He can only assume that right is an action consistent with fact. But if he discovers that an action within himself is producing nothing good in himself, what defense has he for the continuance of it? If this defense has to do only with the continuance of the general pattern of his habits, then his position is indefensible. He must determine in his own nature certain values, and he must attempt to rationalize the means of attaining them. Now, we all know that it is extremely difficult to change the outward structure of society around us. We also know that it is extremely difficult to change the attitudes of persons with whom we must have certain continuous or occasional association. Therefore, our adjustments, factually speaking, must in every instance be an adjustment of discovery and experience in relationship to ourselves. We cannot expect or require that other persons will share our insight. We can only hope that in the due course of time, they too will be led to the path of fact discovery and experience. In the meantime, however, we have decisions that have to be made. These decisions today are becoming more pressing than ever before. And it is because of the pressing nature of these decisions that we have this tremendous upsurge of mystical living and thinking, ranging from the restoration of faith healing in our churches to the cultivation of Zen Buddhism. This tremendous gamut is a reflection of man's personal acceptance that he has discovered his own inadequacy. Now, this discovery is factual because he must live with himself. He finds he cannot, or that if he manages to endure the association, it is incomplete, unsatisfying, and even unfriendly. Through the discovery, therefore, of the fact of maladjustment, he is confronted with the challenge of applying this discovery directly to the interior mechanisms of his own experience. He must then decide, simply and directly, whether he will continue in his way and expect to bear the consequences of his error, or whether he is becoming weary of this relationship between cause and effect and is inclined to attempt to remedy the situation. The tendency to remain as he is satisfies a static nature quality which he possesses. It seems to be the line of least resistance, or the line of least decision, or perhaps the line which might, to the least degree, curtail certain satisfactions which he regards as partial compensations for insecurity. For instance, he may be perfectly aware that his way of life is likely to bring him to the grave prematurely, that he will live only 50 or 60 years when he might otherwise live 70 or 75 years, and that in the 50 or 60 years he will have considerable more sickness, pain, misery, and perhaps unemployment through incapacity, but he will do as he pleases. Or he may live more moderately, with better control and discipline of himself, extend his period of usefulness, improve his health, save himself a great deal of pain and annoyance, have more friends, a better family, and children developing in a more secure and proper atmosphere. He must decide from his discovery of these facts what he is going to do. If he does nothing and continues along in his old accustomed way, then the discovery does not lead to experience. And because this discovery does not impel him to the personal acceptance of the truth that has been revealed, and this personal acceptance in turn has not led to an immediate modification in his own conduct, then the sequence which we know brings about the mystical experience has not been established. Because he has learned a thing to be true does not make this mystical experience inevitable. Because he accepts it does not make it inevitable. But if to acceptance he adds a measure of dedication, by means of which he resolves to live according to the highest degree of light that has been accorded to him, and he immediately places himself under the authority of this light, forbidding by nature or instinct or interest any action destructive to this revelation of fact, then he begins to move toward mysticism, because he begins to change the psychic chemistry of his own interior nature. There is no doubt in the world that this procedure, if it could be rendered scientific, would carry us much further than the types of psychoanalysis that we have today. For these are concerned constantly with trying to help us to know more and be the same and still comfortable. A very difficult formula, one that has not yet been perfected. Although no doubt in the world that some of our prominent business corporations will work on it. It will be most attractive if man can break the law and enjoy life to the fullest. and man would gradually accept this as being perfectly right and proper and refer to it as scientific progress. But nature forbids it. And what nature forbids, man cannot accomplish. Man can use nature. Man can abuse nature to a degree. But nature turns relentlessly upon those that abuse it. And man cannot escape from the pattern, the vast organic structure by which the entire economy of the world is sustained. If then we take some simple situation that can arise, the individual discovers, for instance, a natural tendency to prevaricate. In less pleasant language, he is a confirmed liar. By confirmed, we do not mean that he lies all the time. He only lies when it seems to bring him some kind of advantage. But after a while, one lie that is necessary requires two more to support it, and truth becomes virtually extinct. This individual suddenly faces the fact, not because he has been injured immediately by this particular lie, although perhaps a series of critical situations may bring the requirement of remedy closer to his attention, but he suddenly experiences nature through a discovery of truthfulness, of verisimilitude. Nature never lies. A man discovering this and beginning to contemplate on the innumerable complications that come to him through prevarication may come to the conclusion that not to lie is better than to lie. This may be called a theological victory. It is the victory of right over wrong as far as theory is concerned. But if the person, having discovered this and rationalized it, remains a liar, which can well happen and often does, nothing of vital significance has been finally accomplished. But if this person, having this discovery, suddenly realizes that it is the will of God, as expressed by the law of nature, that he be truthful, and begins to worship through truthfulness, and to experience the interior benefits of truthfulness. Discovery plus experience produces an opening or an awakening or a vitalizing of value, leading inevitably to an experience of truth, an experience of earned truth, of the victory of truth over error, and most of all, the personal experience that the individual can achieve to any good that he determines to achieve. And that through this achievement, he opens his conviction to further achievement and discovers in the long run that his truthfulness is a tremendous improvement in the total pattern of his probable happiness, security, and friendliness. Out of this new relationship, he experiences a closer relationship with the plan of life, with the purpose of things as they are. But this relationship is not possible while the individual who believes in telling the truth still lies. If a person who believes in telling the truth is by this means brought into a religious movement, affirming the value of truth, discussing it, arguing it, preaching it, teaching it, and forcing it upon everyone else, but remaining untruthful himself, this individual, should he possess any psychic attenuation of faculty, will have a delusionary experience. Because he cannot have the true experience apart from his own experience of truth. Mysticism, then, is this continually unfolding experience of value. One of the most common of all of our unhappy situations is one which is much nearer to us and often less easily integrated than some spectacular vice like forthright prevarication or alcoholism or total immoral depravity. These things are so-called large problems. But these large problems never have to really be faced as such because they are nothing but accumulation of neglected small problems and ultimately have to be so dissolved. But we have certain basic problems. And the most basic problem that we all have, and the one that stands between nearly every person and the beginning of mystical apperception, is the problem of personal non-tranquility. You can say that it is due to any one of 100 different circumstances and factors. But we have the very difficult situation of the person who is not really bad and at the same time is not much good. This taxes our ingenuity. Because when you try to say to such an individual, you are wrong about this, they look at you so innocently. The little mistakes that they make should certainly not be held against them, especially when compared to the large mistakes everybody else makes. So non-tranquility, which is just a certain general disorder, a kind of disorder that corresponds in physical symptomology to what they used to call a pining condition. In the old days, people who did not feel too well either pined or had a misery. Now, misery could be almost anything from a touch of rheumatism to a toothache. But a misery was just not feeling good. And in our problem of fact and unfact, or non-fact, this problem of the misery is this situation of the individual who is just a little miserable all the time, or most of the time, and has a pathetic look of unbelief on their faces if for a moment they are not miserable. These individuals are made up of the world's good-hearted people, the well-intentioned ones, the ones who are so well-meaning that it just seems terrible to say anything unkind about them. But this type of negative non-adjustment can and does block nearly all of our positive efforts to grow spiritually. And a person in this condition of perpetual misery, trying to unfold religious convictions, or to advance spiritually, or to cultivate extrasensory perception, is in the most deplorable, miserable condition of all, because he is in constant danger of hallucination. The hallucination does not seem as though it should naturally follow. After all, he's only a little bad. All right, nature is just. He only has a little hallucination. But a little hallucination gets very much larger when we think about it. The hallucination rapidly develops overtones much more than the little badness with which it was associated. And most persons who have this kind of hallucination include in it the strange imagination or fantasy which would insist that they are better than they are, which is the most comforting form of fantasy. and very often paralyzes any further effort to correct the cause. The individual promptly forgets the cause, forgets his own needs, and dashes off in the service of some hallucinational destiny which he feels awaits him in larger worlds to conquer. So this problem of the small misery is one thing which is so frequently overlooked, so consistently denied, or excused away with a gallant gesture. Here is the common problem of mysticism in relationship to life. It is also the problem of life, because most people are not very bad and not very good. And it is out of this general dilemma that many of our most terrible tyrannies have arisen. The moment we recognize that we have a certain number of faults, even though they be minor ones, our fact discovery must go to work on them. It must recognize that religion, in terms of mysticism, is the systematic rededication of attitudes and impulses so that they become useful rather than useless. That they become, even in smallest matters, basically constructive. And that there is a clear allegiance in which every resource that we have is dedicated to the best use that we can make of that resource. Now, this does not mean that our small virtues are dedicated to some vast project. It means that small virtues are dedicated to small, necessary, immediate ends. And that through the continual experiencing of these, they add up. And a few years of careful recognition of the principles involved will, and usually does, bring about a marked increase of apperception on the part of the individual. Now, another problem that often perturbs us a little is the fact that we try desperately for 6 months, and at the end of that time we are not illuminated. The mystical experience hasn't happened. Therefore, the bottom is out of the ethical universe, and we go on without hope, giving up any tiresome project that seems so rewardless. A few years ago, under this type of situation, the individual always changed teacher or joined a new movement. It was obvious that he wasn't getting anywhere. But where was he trying to get? What he had hoped to do was to take 1 ounce of base metals and transmute them into a ton of pure gold. He was entirely out of his depth. He did not realize that if his procedure was accurate and correct, he was developing his mystical apperception, whether he realized it or not. This apperception was not sufficiently strong to open the heavens until they resembled the vision of Dante. These achievements were small achievements which he magnified because it is so difficult for the average person to do anything well. If he has one victory, he feels that all the universe should pause and admire it. Actually, his reward was that with each discovery transmuted into experience action, he gained a little greater skill in further discovery. That if he did not falsify his own records, he would find that as the result of correcting even one minor peculiarity of disposition, he had a new orientation on life. Perhaps not vastly new, but an orientation that gave him control of some situation, gave him insight to some degree that he did not previously possess. Thus his journey, beginning as it must with the single step, continues, and each step is a single step. But a man taking enough of them finally comes to the end of his journey. The end of the journey, like the beginning of the journey, is also a single step. We have become so hopeful that we could jump over vast hurdles quickly, then believe definitely that in a few months we could attain victory over sickness or sorrow or despair of one kind or another, that we simply fail to observe nature's way. We have not discovered the facts of this situation. And because we have failed to discover the facts, we have interpreted them wrongly. And from this wrong interpretation have come to our own despair, our disillusionment, and our sense of futility. Beginning then to think in terms of scientific mysticism, as the Greeks and early Christians understood it, asceticism is merely a term for unworldliness. It has nothing to do with an individual going away and living alone in a cave. Asceticism is the individual creating a code by means of which he refuses to compromise principle for advantage. A code by which he firmly and sincerely believes that through attaining a certain interior orientation, he will justify and inevitably receive an enlargement of interior apprehension, that he will be delivered from certain evils to the degree that he delivers himself from certain errors. The idea of a vicarious atonement for these situations has in itself had a markedly detrimental effect upon Western civilization. It has helped the individual to actually take the belief that it is not necessary for him to immediately and initially correct his own qualities. Now, this is not the big moral problem that most persons assume it to be. And all the preaching in the world sounds forbidding and negative and certainly platitudinous, but it has very little to do with the fact itself. It has been proven on every occasion that it takes no more energy to do it well than do it badly. That the individual is not required to give up things that are near and dear to him, unless these things are so basically unworthy that they should not be near and dear to anyone. Nature does not demand that the person desert his responsibilities or his problems. It simply requires a continuous evidence of purposed growth. And while man grows, nature rejoices. When man stops growing, nature comes up behind and prods him appropriately. Nature refuses to permit the individual to stop growing. And most of so-called growing pains are the individual resisting growth, or some bodily structure that is not keeping up with the national or natural pattern of nature's intent. To grow, then, is to be natural. And it is perfectly proper and natural that man should grow to the degree that his interior faculties become the active agents in the directing of his activity and conduct. It is part of nature's law that the human being shall be self-ruled, self-governed. And as an incident or natural evidence of this, we realize that every other form of government has failed. And we also realize, as Plato pointed out, that if man is self-governing, it makes very little difference what type of political structure he lives under. the self-governing man can live well under any government. The man who is not self-governed cannot live well even under the best government. And if peoples are so afflicted, the best government is rapidly corrupted. Thus, the tendency of nature to force us to grow, to continually unfold our potential, means a motion from our exterior and grosser perceptions to our interior and more refined perceptions. We know, for example, that for man to be truly greater than he is, he must know more than he does. In order for man to be oriented in the total universe, in order that spiritually, psychically, intellectually, emotionally, and physically, he shall be in all things sufficient, and that this sufficiency should in its own expression be the full growth of that person, the full exhibition of the grace, power, dignity, and honor of that person, that to attain this end, even with relative completeness, we must have faculties we do not now functionally possess. We know that the individual must sometime be adjusted to an invisible world of principles, as now he is adjusted only to a visible world of effects. We know that the time will come when man will outgrow the lessons that materiality can teach him. In spite of his complicated way of life, these lessons are comparatively few, and diagramming human situations as they can exist in life has already demonstrated there are only about 40 things that can happen to a human being, and all the complicated plots of history are merely combinations of these basic happenings. Thus man lives, phenomenally speaking, in a limited universe, in which a limited group of adjustments confront him. Yet even if he makes all these adjustments, he is not yet perfect, inasmuch as the physical universe does not provide him with the most necessary of all ingredients, and that is the apperception of causes. Man is not able to examine naked principles. He is not able to know things according to their true natures. He can know them only according to their seeming and not according to their essence. But man, in order to attain to the full expression of his own humanity and reach upward towards participation in his own divinity, man must have more faculties, more powers, more abilities than he presently is able to use. The mystical experience, therefore, in most systems of mysticism is acknowledged to be a simple and natural faculty, normally available to the individual who has proven through conduct that it is next for him that he should be raised to a new level of interior experience, that new kinds of universal facts must be revealed to him in order that his own growth can properly continue. When in the next degree of his own growth requires an extension of faculties, then and then only the mystical experience is a proper and normal thing. Forced in any other way, it is a forced and unnatural thing. And when forced or unnatural, it is inevitably heavily involved in illusion, because man cannot force his power to apperceive truth. He cannot achieve a pseudo spirituality. He can achieve a pseudo-hysteria. He can achieve a false state which he may regard as spiritual. But he cannot achieve a union or an at-one-ment with a superior condition until that union is the next thing necessary for him. He must therefore build toward this through the exhaustion of the consciousness wisdom content of those testimonies which can be bestowed upon him by faculty perception. Now, what does this discipline lead to? To what does man turn, or what does he become, if we may assume that by continual growth he gradually exhausts the 40 some odd situations of which flesh is heir in the problem of living? It really means that each individual, by this exhaustion, gradually eliminates a false concept, a false standard, or a false code of action. Mysticism assumes that by the gradual relaxation of error, it is possible for the individual to achieve a tremendous amount through the intensification of his own dedication. Nature recognizes two factors in the increasing of the tempo of human progress. One is growth in extensity, and the other is growth in intensity. Extensity is a problem of time in which experience is diversified over a very large area and is available to man in sequences, so that in so many years or so many lifetimes he may attain to a certain degree of knowing. This means growth along evolutionary lines with incredible vistas of time, leading ultimately to the attainment of the desired end. Intensity, however, means the speeding up of time through intensive effort, in which the person chooses to move more rapidly. Intensity is not a substitute for extensity. The intense individual who wishes to achieve in 5 years what another man may take 10 to accomplish has only one recourse, namely that he must work twice as hard. He cannot attain this end until a measure of achievement required has been attained or achieved. Therefore, as Euclid of Megara said, there is no royal road to learning. There is no royal road to illumination. There is no trick by which it can be done. What we observe occasionally as a more rapid motion is actually a more intense procedure. And intensity usually results from increased dedication, greater alertness, stronger resolution to achieve a certain purpose, and perhaps the experience that the end is so desirable that certain other less desirable things can be easily sacrificed to that end. But the only thing that can be sacrificed is error. Man never sacrifices truth. He can only give up what is not so. For what is so is not divisible from himself at any time. He can obscure it, but he cannot successfully renounce it. Therefore, all that he can give up is his own inadequacy. And the rapidity with which he resolves to do this results in the intensity in the life of certain individuals. Intensity may arise from a variety of causes. Inspiration, noble example, critical situations, a certain type of common instruction. It is easier in one generation than another because of the attitudes of persons. In those ages and days in which culture was recognized, culture achievement was more rapid. In days in which scientific progress is recognized, scientific progress will be more rapid. The individual will find it easier to grow according to the pressures of his time. But as he goes further into his life, he finds that the greater pressures are his own need, his own interior realization, and his dawning sense of spiritual values. Thus he may grow a little faster than his neighbor. But this does not mean he is favored, or that he has been selected, or that he has been ordained to a spiritual aristocracy. It simply means that he is willing and able to roll up his sleeves and work harder. There can be no achievement by accident. All achievement is by experience intent. If we follow these patterns, we will observe the natural civilization of our species. We will observe, therefore, that mysticism is an overtone of biology, that it moves with anthropology and ethnology, that all of these elements work together, and that man, achieving a certain platform of culture, becomes aware of self-culture, becomes aware of the possibility of advancing by his own intention this evolutionary procedure which is moving around him in nature. This was the great concept of alchemy: man as an artist perfecting nature. And when the individual uses his interior resources to anticipate and advance the proper works of nature, he becomes then the alchemist, and also the faithful gardener, and the faithful shepherd. It is his own dedicated determination to move with life more directly, more completely, more sincerely, that leads to what we call the exceptional case of mysticism. Very often, the intellectual faculties are not entirely clear on this, but what might be termed a general intellection, known as aspiration, takes over. An aspiration is a union of the mental and emotional faculties in the determination to experience the presence of God. When this aspiration is strong enough to cause the individual to instinctively cast off that which is contrary to the fulfillment of this aspiration, we may have examples of mysticism, as in the case of St. Francis of Assisi, St. Francis of Sales, and many other of the mystics, St. Hildegard of Bingen, Santa Teresa. These represent the individual now devoting himself to the service of his own aspirational nature, but the service always accompanied by a decreasing self-awareness, until, as the Persian and Near Eastern mystic puts it, the individual forgets himself in God. The end of all observation, discovery, experience is the reduction of the ego equation in the individual, the elevation of principle above personality, the elevation of reality above appetite or selfishness or self-interest or self-pity. These are all victories of the impersonal over the personal. They are the victories of a divine purpose over human negations. Wherever this victory is hastened, your mysticism becomes more naturally apparent. But if we have superphysical phenomena separated from these dedications and these achievements, we are going to have hallucination. We're going to have a pseudo-experience, one in which the individual may be deceived into the belief that he is growing, and growing beautifully. But he has failed to observe that this growth is not justified by his own self-directed. The individual finds that he still has his faults, but is also having experiences. This discovery should cause him pause immediately, for he should know that something is wrong. Nature does not reward that which has not achieved any more than it punishes that which has achieved. Therefore, any experience inconsistent with the dedicated growth of the individual must be viewed with suspicion. Only the individual can sit down and honestly determine these facts in a factual manner. If he is not able to do so, he is already heavily under hallucination. But he may come to secondary testimony in the fact that his affairs go badly. And in the world in which this occurs, in his own interior relationships, he cannot control the world around him, but where his own inner life is not growing to some degree, becoming a little mellower and a little softer and a little kinder every day, he must be suspicious of any apparent extrasensory extension that he may have. Thus, the entire subject becomes basically scientific. And on the basis of this scientific foundation, we can continue next week with the next degree of our study. And we thank you.